This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. A Honolulu City Council committee has tentatively given the nod to the interim appointment of former transportation official Mike Formby to fill the East Honolulu slot that was held by Councilmember Trevor Ozawa. Ozawa had some strong words following a decision that went against him in the election. Unusual talk, criticizing judges, particularly if you're an attorney. He raised the issue of his opponent, Tommy Waters, serving on the Judicial Selection Committee that resulted in the appointment of some of those justices. Here's part of what he said.
At the end of the day, it's the justices' decision, and they decide among themselves whether or not they can be fair. Maybe they felt they could be fair, but let me say that the sense of impropriety existed. You know, when you these are facts. You know, when you have somebody with the type of political inside connections that Mr. Waters has had with the judiciary, and I didn't mention that he was also the House Judiciary Chair for years, you know, in control of their budget and different things like that in the past. It's a little too close for comfort.
In a rare move, the Hawaii Supreme Court responded to his criticism with the statement released that weekend following Ozawa's Saturday press conference denying any impropriety. The case had some interesting parallels for retired Judge Dan Foley, who also made a career as a civil rights attorney. We had a conversation with him recently about protected speech.
Well, you know, I'm no stranger to strong words, and I've been on the receiving end, especially when I was a lawyer for the ACLU doing same-sex marriage. I've seen the court decision in same-sex marriage was attacked not only by citizens, but the legislature, governors, whatnot. So this is not new terrain for me, but what it really reminded me of was a case in the mid-1980s when the Office of Disciplinary Counsel filed a complaint against former prosecutor Charles Marsland. Chuck had been in office a couple of terms and was extremely critical of judges and lawyers in the criminal justice system that he felt were too pro-defendant and didn't protect public safety. And he made all sorts of allegations against judges and lawyers, including me, when I represented the ACLU on prison reform, reducing prison population. He accused me of endangering the public by putting dangerous people on the street and other things. When I challenged the pornography statute for the ACLU and won in the Hawaii Supreme Court, he accused me of endangering the public again. But he couldn't find anyone to represent him before the Office of Disciplinary Counsel, so ironically, he ended up at my law office that I shared with Earl Partington. And Earl and I represented him and filed a complaint in federal district court saying that Mr. Marsland's speech was protected under the United States First Amendment, and we were prepared to defend him. That the statements he made, but we were arguing it was protected speech. Shortly after we filed that federal district court complaint, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel decided to reverse course and withdrew their complaint against Marsland. So the parameters of the First Amendment were never adjudicated. Now, one of the reasons why I thought of the Marsland case when I was following this Trevor Ozawa incident is that Mr. Ozawa and Mr. Marsland were not just lawyers. They were elected public officials. And one of the arguments Earl and I made is that public officials should be able to express their opinion. It's in the interest of the public to have public officials speak frankly, and to muzzle them would not be in the public interest. But as I said, it was never adjudicated. But that's what came to mind when I followed this Trevor Ozawa press.
And there were some constituents who had raised the question as to whether it was appropriate for him to criticize the judges. He is an attorney, and he had raised his concern that his opponent, Tommy Waters, was on the Judicial Selection Committee at the time I think some of the judges were being considered.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the Hawaii Supreme Court responded, basically said that had nothing to do with their decision, that you know, Mr. Waters was one of nine of justices that voted on two, not the three, as Mr. Ozawa said, And so they defended themselves and put it out in the public square for the public to consider and weigh. So Mr. Ozawa's allegations were answered. And that's what the First Amendment is about, is to have this public debate, to let people listen. You know, whether he violated the canon of ethics for lawyers, I'm not going to voice an opinion. But what I'm saying is there certainly is an issue when it comes to the First Amendment. We have a case out of Hawaii, and I cited this case when I was doing the Marsalin case, In re Boslock or In re Sawyer. We had a labor lawyer, Harriet Boslock, who defended people that were being prosecuted under the Federal Smith Act for being communists in federal district court here. And she gave a speech on the Big Island in Honoka'a criticizing these prosecutions. And the Territorial Bar Association suspended her license, took her license away from criticizing these prosecutions and the court proceedings. And she went up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in that case, the U.S. Supreme Court reversed the Territorial Bar and said her speech was protected by the First Amendment. And so we cited that case when we represented Charles Marsalin.
And I was trying to remember whether Marsalin's remarks, you know, what the context was, because I know, you know, he had a situation where his son was killed, and you thought that his comments came, though, as part of an election loss?
He'd been in office a couple of terms at least, and when they filed the complaint against Chuck, that was, you know, a while back. I can't remember every allegation, but it was pretty much everything he said negative about judges and lawyers when he was prosecutor. So they waited till he left office and then just went through and put it all together and filed the complaint. Whether that particular criticism was in the complaint, I can't recall. Anybody can file a complaint, and complaints filed with ODC are private. So whether a complaint has been filed, nobody would know, and not even Mr. Ozawa, unless he's asked to respond. I'm not saying Mr. Ozawa's, and I don't know Mr. Ozawa's, never had any contact with Mr. Ozawa. With Mr. Waters, the only contact I've had is when I appeared before the Judicial Selection Commission when he was a member. But if you put yourself in Ozawa's place for a minute, whether you agree or disagree, he thought he had just won an election by 22 votes, and all of a sudden 350 votes that had been counted, and if were counted, he would have won, were invalidated. And you can, and as far as I know, that was an unprecedented decision by our Hawaii Supreme Court. Many people have challenged election results and gotten nowhere. This is the first one I'm aware of that really had legs that overturned an election. Well, clearly an emotional moment for him. I think he would have been better off choosing his words more carefully, checking his facts before he made allegations. But, you know, having been a civil rights lawyer a good part of my life and representing the ACLU, I think that if there's any question on whether comments criticizing public officials now, we're not talking about some innocent person in the private sector, public officials who are very capable of answering and defending themselves, as our Supreme Court justices did. I'm always of the inclination, err on the side of the First Amendment, let the public debate take place, let all sides be heard, and let individuals decide.
This case, I think, was also unprecedented in that the Supreme Court responded to Mr. Ozawa's remarks on the weekend.
Yes. Yes, I haven't seen that before. I've been practicing law here since 84. Yeah, I've never seen a court specifically defend a particular decision. Usually what they do is they leave it up to the lawyers on the prevailing side to defend the decision and not try to do it themselves. So that was unusual. So Mr. Ozawa certainly got their attention.
I can only think of one other time when I was in a newsroom where we got something from the Supreme Court, and at the time we thought, "Is this a joke? You know, this is like a Saturday or a Sunday, and they're putting something out," and we'd never seen one from them. It was, I think, the issue then was the selection of the Bishop of State Trustees, And so we were real cautious. We're like, well, we don't know if this is bogus or not. They're working on a weekend?
That was unusual, that whole broken trust scenario. So that was unusual. That was all unprecedented as well. And remember then, they were responding as private citizens, remember?
Yes.
They said they acted in selecting trustees as private citizens, not as justices. So they weren't responding as justices there as they were here.
That was Dan Foley, retired judge and attorney, talking about First Amendment issues surrounding the election controversy in District 4 covering East Honolulu. Is the conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. It's official. Today marks the first day of the lunar calendar, Year of the Boar, Konghi Fat Choi. For today's quiz, we're exploring the history of a privately held community bank in Honolulu's Chinatown. Located on the corner of North King and Smith Street, the main branch of Hawaii National Bank opened on September 19, 1960. Founder K.J. Luke was a Big Island boy whose business acumen probably started early as he was tasked with tending his father's general store. He excelled in his studies at the University of Hawaii and graduated with honors in accounting. He then went on to earn his MBA from Harvard, and according to the bank's website, opening day started with the traditional firing of 10,000 firecrackers. By the time the bank closed, it had taken in $6.2 million in deposits, a national record for any first-day deposits for a new bank. Over the past five decades, the local institution has grown to 13 branches on Oahu, Maui, and the Big Island. So for today's Lunar New Year quiz, can you tell us what was the Chinese zodiac animal when the Hawaii National Bank opened? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Hi, aloha. I'm Jairus Grove from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Eating disorders. It's about food and not about food. Dr. Anita Johnson founded the Bulimia and Anorexic Center of Hawaii back in the 1980s. Some 30 million people across the globe suffer from eating disorders. The issue is highlighted across the world this month. Johnson says so much has been learned over the last three decades.
Back then, anorexia had just become recognized in the general public because Karen Carpenter had just died from that. Bulimia just became a diagnosis. And binge eating disorder, which is the largest eating disorder and the most underdiagnosed, wasn't even on the radar. And back then, treatment was very minimal. There was hospitalization for someone who was quite ill, and there was a little bit of outpatient help, but not much was known, really, not a lot of research. So we've come a long ways. There are multiple levels of care available, from individual outpatient, where someone might work with a therapist and a dietitian. Then there's the level of care of intensive outpatient treatment that we have in Honolulu, where you might go 3 to 4 evenings a week for support. Then the next level of care higher up from that is called PHP, where you pretty much spend the whole day getting the support you need and then go home in the evening. And then the next level of care is residential for those that need just that level of support in order to recover. And that's the program we have on Maui. And then the highest level of care, which all the other levels are designed to try to prevent, is hospitalization when someone becomes medically compromised because of whatever's going on with them and food and eating and their bodies.
Folks may not be aware that we even have a residential center here. How long has that been open?
We had Aipono Maui. We opened our doors about 5 years ago. And that was really exciting because up until then, if someone needed residential treatment, they had to go to the mainland and, you know, leave their jobs and their families and their homes and all of that. Whereas now it's not that far away.
And so you talked about recovery.
Many people don't understand this, but full, complete recovery from an eating disorder is absolutely, totally possible. So I've been working in the field for 35 years, and I know of thousands that have totally, completely recovered, even those who have been struggling for a long time or had very, very severe life-threatening eating disorders. So I know that it's totally, completely possible. But in order to do that, it requires that you get to the underlying issues. So eating disorders are kind of like a weed. If you just cut it off at the top, given the right circumstances, it can come right back. But if you go down and get the roots and clear those roots, it's a done deal. You can live a life totally free from struggles with eating and dieting and weight and all of that.
You and I both grew up in Guam, mm-hmm. and food is a big deal in an island culture like it is here in Hawaii.
The problem isn't the cultural situations that are connected to food, because you're going to find that in every culture on the planet, some more to one degree than another. The problem is diet culture. That is what has contributed to the epidemic of eating disorders, because eating disorders require a lot of different factors. It could be trauma. It could be genetics. It could be a certain personality type. It could be family issues. There's a lot of things that can basically load the gun. But the one thing that pulls the trigger is a diet. So diet mentality, and I remember I was talking to one of my best friends from when we were growing up, because people have asked me, well, did you ever have an eating disorder? And I go, well, no, but I should have, because I have the right personality for it. So I was asking a friend of mine, because we grew up on Guam in the 50s and 60s, and I said, you know, maybe I'm not remembering correctly, but do you remember people dieting back then? And did your mom diet? And because my mom didn't diet. And really, no, dieting wasn't a big deal back then. Now, you can fast forward just a number of years, and diet culture reached Guam as well. And so that is really the culprit. This idea, the fat phobia, the idea that your worth is based on the size of your body, it has permeated everything now. And in my mind, that's the real culprit.
What should be top of mind then as we acknowledge eating disorders this week?
Number one is to understand, if anyone is ever struggling, that recovery is totally, completely possible. And number two, there's a skill set required. So what I discovered years ago in 1983, when we created the Anorexia and Bulimia Center of Hawaii, and as I mentioned before, not much was known back then. And I was supervising a psychology student who was doing her doctoral dissertation on the incidence of eating disorders in Hawaii. And we would get together with a social worker who had recovered herself and to try to figure out what was going on. And the social worker had to figure it out because there was no one to help. And so we kept saying, well, gee, there ought to be a center for this. A lot of people are struggling. And after we said it about the fifth time, we looked at each other and we laughed and we said, okay, here we are. And so the Anorexia and Bulimia Center of Hawaii was born. And back then, I wasn't sure what was going on. But it was sort of like you create it and they come. And girls and women of all walks of life all ages, all ethnicities, all sizes, all different kinds of struggles with eating and weight started showing up. And I found myself asking, okay, well, what is it? What is the common denominator? First of all, why is it females? Because back then it was only females. That's not the case nowadays. Second, why is it these particular girls and women? And third, why is the struggle around eating and body? And what I discovered is that these individuals were what I call thin skin. They were very emotionally sensitive and highly intuitive, and had been. They were born that way. But and there's not a problem with being highly emotionally sensitive and very intuitive unless you grow up in a culture like ours that doesn't value that, that says, oh, get over it, or you're being too emotional, or you're overreacting, or you need to be, you know, dealing with it without getting so emotional. So what happens is they get this idea that there's something wrong with me, and they're not sure exactly what it is. And I'm talking as young as like age 4, where a little kid would say something like, well, but mommy, if daddy loves us so much, how come he never comes home at night, or some such thing. But what happened when they would speak up, they would either be ignored or rejected, or maybe even ridiculed, or in some instances abused. So they had to find some way to dim their light. And to understand where eating comes in, because really what they wanted more than anything else in the world, what all of us want more than anything else in the world, is a sense of belonging. But they confuse that with fitting in, which isn't the same thing. So they had to find some way to see if they could get themselves to think like and look like and act like and feel like how they thought others would want them to think and look and act and feel. Now, where food would come into the picture is if you imagine yourself driving down a road, and you've been down this road hundreds of times, but this time you're starving or on a diet, same thing. What gets your attention is every fast food restaurant, every, you know, food. So if your struggle has been that, oh, I don't belong, I don't fit in, something's wrong with me, then now all of a sudden, you got it. Oh, I know what's wrong with me. I like food too much. I think about food too much. And that's where it all gets turned to an eating disorder. So it's sort of like what happens is the eating and the food becomes a red herring. So like in a whodunit mystery, you're following who killed the old lady, the maid, the butler, the chauffeur, and everyone's watching the maid because she's kind of strange. She's peculiar. And at the end of the story, there's a twist. And it was the butler, who nobody suspected because everyone's watching the maid. Well, the maid's the red herring. The food, the weight, is the red herring. And it distracts you from what the real issues are. And because of that distraction, the real issues never get resolved. And the focus continues to be on, I'm too fat, I gotta lose weight.
And you mentioned that we're seeing it also now in males.
Yes. Now it's starting to happen with men as well, whereas and I don't know if that had been the case all along and they just weren't showing up to get help, but now we're starting to see it, not to the degree that is still with females. And I think in a way our culture does contribute to that, because by and large, even though it's changing, thank goodness, by and large, females are judged on how they look and men on how they perform. But now what's happening is males are getting judged on whether or not they have a six-pack, and so now they're starting to feel that pressure as well.
Dr. Anita Johnson specializes in eating disorders and is speaking at an international conference in California this week. She's a clinical director of Aipono Hawaii, a residential treatment center on Maui.
Support for The Conversation comes from Haleakala Waldorf School on Maui and Honolulu Waldorf School on Oahu, serving Hawaii's families from infancy with parent-child programs through high school, now accepting applications at both schools.
Paying for porn, that's the story our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat have online this morning. Investigations editor John Hill joins us for our reality check. Morning.
Good morning.
So the headline certainly made my eyes pop.
Yeah, it is kind of an attention grabber.
So tell us about these bills that lawmakers are considering.
Basically, they would require, there's some variations between them, but in general, they would require anybody who manufactures or distributes a device that accesses the internet to include a blocker that would prevent people from seeing things like child pornography and revenge porn. But then, although the bills are not entirely clear on this point, but it appears that what would happen would be that if you paid $20 to the state of Hawaii, you could have the blocker lifted, and that would enable you to watch. Obviously not. Nobody is I don't think the lawmakers are thinking that you would then be able to watch illegal things like child pornography, but that will allow you to watch legal pornography.
Well, this is such a strange story.
It is.
So tell us, I mean, how did this whole concept get going?
Well, that's an interesting aspect of the story. There have been a couple of people who have been promoting these bills nationwide. There's been more than a dozen states in the past year or so that have introduced bills very similar to these ones. And one of these individuals is named Chris Sevier, and he has a history of rather colorful actions, including suing Apple because Apple failed to prevent his own porn addiction, and also trying to marry his own computer as a protest against same-sex marriage.
Yeah, that's pretty strange.
Yeah, and apparently he has an associate who was involved in that lawsuit in Utah where they were both trying to marry a computer in a polygamous relationship, according to their lawsuit. And that individual contacted State Senator Mike Gabbard in Hawaii, and he introduced the first of these bills last year.
So what did Gabbard have to say about these bills?
He was unaware of the pasts of the bios of the people who brought this to him, but he said it was he was more interested in being able to get the conversation going about stopping human trafficking. The reason human trafficking is related to this bill is that the $20 would go to a special fund, and the state would be able to make grants from that fund to organizations that were battling human trafficking. So. Senator Gabbard's position was, well, at least these bills will get that conversation started.
And one of these bills is actually being heard today, right?
That's right. Yeah, there was one of the bills had a hearing on the Committee on Interstate Commerce, so we'll see how that goes. Last year, Senator Gabbard had introduced a bill that basically got no hearing. It may have gotten a hearing, but it didn't get very far.
Okay, and so I don't know. What does the ACLU think about this?
The ACLU says it's completely unconstitutional. They've been tracking these bills across the country, and they say that you can't, you know, the First Amendment doesn't come with a $20 asterisk. If content is protected by the First Amendment, it's protected by the First Amendment, and you can't put a surcharge on it.
Okay, and so we'll have to see where these bills go this session.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see because I think that there are some pretty compelling arguments that they are unconstitutional on the face of them. And there are a number of organizations that cite various Supreme Court decisions and other court decisions that say that you cannot impose a mandatory blocker like this.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, John. Really interesting story.
Well, thank you.
That was Investigations Editor John Hill with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
President Trump offered a compromise on immigration in last year's State of the Union.
So let's come together, set politics aside, and finally get the job done.
1 year later, Washington is still in gridlock over the wall. People on both sides of the border are looking for new signs of compromise. That's on the world.
This afternoon at 1.
Educators don't normally deceive their students, but every once in a while they have a good reason to do so. That was the case at one local school when a staff member was the secret winner of the Milken Award, often called the Oscar of Teaching. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was on hand for the surprise reveal and has the story.
On Monday, students at Alawai Elementary assembled in the school cafeteria. They were told that some high-ranking officials wanted to talk about the great things happening at their school, which was true. Governor David Ige, Congressman Ed Case, and Department of Education Superintendent Christina Kishimoto were all present, but so was someone else.
There are many great teachers and principals in this country. You can believe me when I say it, because I've been everywhere.
Jane Foley is a retired public school teacher who now works for the Milken Family Foundation. She came to Hawaii to present a Milken Educator Award.
We recognize excellence in the other professions. The best athletes get Most Valuable Player Awards. Entertainers have Grammys, Oscars. In science and medicine, there are Nobel Prizes. But our educators, who have the most important job of all, teaching all the people who get all the other awards and teaching all of you, haven't had that kind of a celebration. That's just wrong.
The big difference between a Milken and an Oscar? Teachers don't know they've been nominated. In fact, there are no nominations. The Milken Foundation works directly with state departments of education to select winners each year.
One of the best educators in the entire country is here, in your school. And before we leave, an educator at Alawai is going to receive this national award. It's the only one in Hawaii this year.
A Milken Award comes with more than just recognition. Winners receive a $25,000 prize. That was of particular interest to the assembled students, who helped make the reveal.
Just imagine if you went to the mailbox one day and there was a check that was sent just to say thank you for your excellence. Let's find out how much the check will be. What do we have here?
$25.
Okay, we have $25. We're already getting excited. What do you think of our $25 for our financial award?
It's not enough.
Luckily, there were a few more zeros stashed around the room, with the last one revealing the full amount.
Let's keep going. Let's try another card.
$250.
Wouldn't you want $250 because someone noticed your excellence?
Yes, but I would like more.
Let's use the last card.
But we still don't know the identity of the winner. Making the big reveal fell to Hawaii Governor David Ige and First Lady Dawn Amano Ige.
The 2019 Milken Educator Award goes to
Sarah King.
Sarah King started at Alawai Elementary teaching first grade. But she's now the Title I coordinator, responsible for managing the funds awarded to Alawai Elementary through a federal education program for low-income schools. She also started a literacy group to help struggling readers and is a coach for the school's Special Olympics team.
This award is amazing for teachers because it's recognizing what we do every single day, you know, and I think a lot of press about teachers out there can often be negative, so it's great that these awards are out here just to highlight what great things are happening around the nation in schools everywhere, and especially in public schools.
Sarah hopes that awards like the Milken can help attract and retain public school teachers here in Hawaii.
I think it'll help maybe inspire other teachers, especially beginning teachers, to kind of stick it out. And I mean, it's just hard because it's so expensive to live here, so I can't fault them for having to leave for that. But I think I'm hoping more recognition and, you know, more assistance for especially beginning teachers straight out of college.
As for that prize money, Sarah already has something in mind.
We just had another baby in June, so we definitely need a bigger car. But also, I want some of it to come back to the school because I wouldn't have gotten this without the school.
From Alawai Elementary School, I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
We've got photos and video from the ceremony posted on our Instagram page. We're at The Conversation HPR. Earlier in the show, we explored the history of Hawaii National Bank, a privately held community bank that first opened over 5 decades ago. It was founded by K.J. Luke, who grew up on the Big Island, and he worked at his father's general store. An alumni of the University of Hawaii's accounting department, he graduated with honors. Luke then went on to earn his MBA from Harvard. Before becoming a banker, Luke was a savvy businessman and a real estate investor. On September 19th, 1960, the new institution started with a traditional lighting of 10,000 firecrackers. By closing time, Hawaii National broke the national record for any first-day deposits for a new bank, receiving $6.25 million in deposits. As this was the first day of the Lunar New Year, we asked you to tell us what the zodiac animal was on that auspicious September day in 1960. And congratulations to Deanna from Aleba Heights. You got it right. The answer we were looking for was the rat, the first in the zodiac cycle of animals. That's today's quiz. And if you have an idea for one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Aloha, I'm Dr. Bob Geffner from the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Home of the Brave is the latest production of Honolulu Theater for Youth. It grew out of children's stories about what it's like to grow up in a military family. The piece was co-commissioned with the La Jolla Playhouse in San Diego and was performed there last year. Take a listen.
I write notes for him and find little presents, and I put them in his shirt and his pants and his shoes. Sometimes I roll up things in his socks. I write, "Be safe," and put it here. And I write, "Stay strong," and hide it there. Last time, when my dad left for deployment, we said our goodbyes and watched him go. I could see him transform from my home dad to my military dad with every step as he walked away. I saw his hand go in his pocket. Inside was a little pink ribbon I always wear in my hair. I bet he could tell what it was because he had tied it for me so many times. I bet it made him smile.
We sat down with actor Jason Lee Hoy, who grew up in the military and served in the armed forces. He was joined by playwright Lee Cataluna, who could relate. While not a military brat, she attended 9 different schools before graduating from high school because of her father's job.
It wasn't until I started working on this project that I kind of quantified it, I guess, for myself. So 4th grade, 5th grade, 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade, and 9th grade, each year was a different school. And I went to 9 different schools before I graduated high school, all in Hawaii, though. So not like, you know, country to country like some military families.
Right, but you could relate to what these kids are experiencing.
Jason and I have talked about like the smell of the boxes, the sound of the tape being stretched on the box, those little stickers that go, the moving stickers that go on the boxes. I mean, just that stuff brings up, you know, the trauma, the excitement, the, you know, all that disarray that happens when you're moving.
Right. Mm-hmm. You can get away from the kids that bully you and make new friends.
It's a fresh start.
There you go. So, Jason, talk about your experience as a military brat.
I was born in Clark Air Force Base in the Philippines, and then from there we moved to Offutt Air Force Base, and then Barksdale Air Force Base, Kirkland Air Force Base, and eventually we ended up out here where my dad taught at IAEA High School, where I graduated from, and I went to three different high schools in three different states. And so that process, like Lee was talking about with the boxes, like I'm so tired of the smell of boxes and just the sound of the moving trucks and the movers coming in and out of the house and touching your personal belongings and just knowing that you live in kind of a culture of impermanence and a culture of goodbyes and how you have to build this strength and resilience. And in the story, it shines light into that world and how these shared experiences build that resilience, not only with the community of military children, but the children that get to experience this change that have to stay there and watch people come and go.
So tell us about this play.
The creative team, you know, myself included, we went onto base and into schools and into classrooms. We talked to students and teachers and principals and counselors and, just everybody, families. So we interviewed like hundreds of people and just sort of asked them their stories. I mean, it wasn't a set of questions. It was more like, so what's it like? And heard the most amazing stories. And then it was my job to sort of form that into a theatrical piece. And what I figured out pretty early on was it wasn't good enough to just go get the stories and gather them, that we needed to go back to the schools. So I did that. I would take my scenes and, you know, ask to go back to the classroom and have the students read them out loud to me and then critique them, which they loved, right? Like, kids love telling a writer what they got wrong. So that was super fun for them and really hard for me. but it was part of this careful checking to make sure, because if we got the smallest thing wrong, then that sort of bounces you out of the entire story, right? They don't know what they're talking about. So we checked a lot to make sure that even though this was fictionalized, dramatized, but it was essentially real and true and honest.
Right, you want something authentic.
Yeah. But, you know, I had this impossible task of telling the story of what it's like to be a child in a military family in 50 minutes. Initially it was four actors. When the play toured in San Diego, I had four actors, and here I have five. But there are infinite stories, right? I mean, there are as many stories about being a kid in a military family as there are kids from military families. So how do you choose, and how do you get enough in so that it seems authentic?
There was a clip that you folks sent over about notes.
The pockets.
Yes.
That monologue was from a family with three sisters here in Hawaii. And we sat with them, with the three girls and their mom and their dad. The girls are all teenagers now. And we just asked them, you know, asked them to share stories about their lives. And they started talking about putting things in their dad's pockets, in the pockets of his uniform as he would be deployed. And as they told the story, their dad, who was sitting there, started crying. And, you know, I started crying, and Eric, the director, started crying, and the girls just told it very matter-of-factly. It's one of my favorite pieces because it's so cleanly from these three girls. Like, I didn't really have to write it. I just had to sort of transcribe it and maybe, you know, tuck it in a little bit. But it was all about, you know, the question of how do you do this? You know, how do you say goodbye to your dad for long periods of time, not knowing when he's going to come home? And for some kids, it was their mom, right? Their mom gets deployed. But those girls sort of answer the question this way about the little notes that they put in their dad's pockets. So do you want to talk about the jacket?
The jacket. I brought in my brother's Army jacket to use in the play, and I was in the Army myself. And every pocket kind of serves a purpose. And there's definitely pockets in pockets, and you kind of get lost in translation putting on this uniform. The first time I heard pockets, I nearly wept in front of all of them, because it is that point where you have to figure out how to say goodbye, because you don't know in that point whether dad's coming home or not. My father was 20 years in the Air Force, and when he went over to Iraq during the first Gulf War, my mom would put us to bed when the sun was still up so that she could watch the news. And we would be in the hallway just watching her, and she just didn't want us to see her cry. So it's this process of coping and hoping that they're going to be okay. And so you leave little things inside the uniform to remind them of you when they're over there, and they're going through the worst of the worst because you have no idea what they're experiencing over there as a child unless you are watching the news. Having to swallow all the tears and be strong for your family members, because they need to see you as strength, because they're going to hold that in their head as the last image that they see. And it's so hard as a kid watching your dad just leave and get on that aircraft and just never know when he's coming back. My older brother, he did 3 tours in Afghanistan, and each tour was 15 months. So that's the amount of time he missed out on his children's lives. And their coping mechanisms, and me stepping in as an uncle and taking them to soccer practice and the basketball practice and keeping them constantly active just to keep their mind off the reality that your dad may or may not return or your mom may or may not return from their deployment.
And I know some families have little routines when they do connect. Well, when my brother came back from the Vietnam War, he came over to my school, and I ran out and gave him a big hug, and then he proceeded to bite me on the nose, and he left teeth marks on my nose, which were visible for weeks.
That was a love bite.
Yes. But I never forgot that.
We hope that families will come, and not just military families, right? Civilian families, because we're all part of this community, right? We're all living here in Hawaii together. And when this play was touring San Diego last year, I happened to go to one performance at a school that was in downtown San Diego. And just, you know, being there in the audience, I could tell something different was going on. There was just a different, like, vibration or something in the audience. And afterwards, the principal came to us and he said, you know, 30% of his student body, they're homeless. And so the question of, so where are you from, hits them in a way that is sort of similar to asking a military child who's lived everywhere, where are you from? But it had its own, like, resonance to it. And then the question of saying goodbye to a family member, you know, some of his students had seen their parents deported, you know, so that whole idea of, you know, watching dad or mom walking away, not knowing when they'd come back or when they'd be reunited, had a certain connection to them. And I think we keep finding that it's not just about military families, it's about families, you know, when dad has to go away for work, when mom has to go away for work, divorce, or just, you know, change, right? How do you deal with change and uncertainty? We were invited to go to Radford High School like 3 different times. Every time they said, hey, do you want to come? We're like, yes. They have a fantastic transition center there that's pretty much run by the students. So when military kids come in, and some of them are coming in like second semester senior year, they are greeted by other military kids who go, we know what this is like. Let's help you, you know, get going. And then there are also counselors and stuff that help them make sure they graduate on time because of the question of different classes, you know, transferring in, right? Different credits. Anyway, we talked to these 4 kids who spent probably 2 hours with us, and they're all seniors. And Eric Johnson, who's the director of the play, asked them this great question. He said, what should definitely be in this play about military kids, and what should definitely not be in this play about military kids? And they said, and this one girl in particular said, it should not sound like a recruiting film for the military. And she said, but no one should ever feel sorry for us. She said, it is a challenging life, but it's a good life, though it's not for everybody. And so those words are like almost exactly in the play because it was so true. And she said, it's totally doable and it's worth it if your mom or your dad loves what they do. And I kept going back to those words because that was kind of a truth of it all. You know, that she was saying, yeah, it's hard. It can be really hard, but it can be really great too. Like, we get to do stuff that none of you civilian people have any idea about.
That's right.
Yeah. And that nobody should feel sorry, but would be cool for us to be able to talk about you know, how we experience life, how we see the world.
And before we close, can you talk about the title, Home of the Brave?
Home of the Brave was actually given to us by a kid who comes from a military family. He's the son of a Navy captain who actually was my student here in Hawaii. And then when we worked on the play in San Diego, his family was in San Diego, and now he's in Virginia. But it came from a speech that he gave that he shared with us, and he talked about how when you go to a public event and somebody sings the national anthem, everybody starts cheering with the line, the land of the free, because there's that tough note to hit. You know, if the singer hits that note, everybody starts cheering. And he said, but the most important line is the one that comes right after that. And it's quiet, you know, and the home of the brave. And that's who we are.
HTY's Home of the Brave starts this Friday and runs weekends through the month at Tenney Theater at St. Andrew's Cathedral.
The government shutdown is over, and President Trump will finally address the nation from inside the House chamber. Will party leaders settle on a plan for border security?
If we make a fair deal, the American people will be proud of their government for proving that we can put country before party.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Join me for NPR's special coverage of the 2019 State of the Union Address from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4.
Well, that's it for today. Up tomorrow, it's a call-in show with Kauai's new mayor. Derek Kawakami talks about his vision for the Garden Isle and the challenges ahead. Join in the conversation with your question or concern. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.